world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Much of the talk about artificial intelligence is about the software, but it all runs on increasingly specialized hardware, much of it made by NVIDIA. We look at the plans of its charismatic co-founder to make hay while the AI sun is absolutely blazing. And America has a troubling shortage in one of its more unglamorous but critical professions, accountants. We ask why their ranks are thinning and what the industry is doing to get them back in and bean counting. But first, you might say it was the technology that most transformed geopolitics. The nuclear bomb. Balancing defense, danger, deterrence has been a preoccupation of every occupant of America's Oval Office since the start of the Cold War. From Dwight Eisenhower,
"The United States, taking account of the Geneva conclusions, is prepared to proceed promptly to negotiate an agreement with other nations which have tested nuclear weapons."
To Jimmy Carter,
"Preventing nuclear war is the foremost responsibility of the two superpowers."
To Ronald Reagan,
"The prevention of conflict and the reduction of weapons are the most important public issues of our time. Yet on no other issue are there more misconceptions."
But now the calculations, the game theory of it all, have changed because the nuclear powers have changed. And seemingly long-settled questions are being asked all over again.
One of the most significant debates early in the Cold War was whether nuclear deterrence was easy or whether it was hard. Was the number of nuclear weapons highly significant, or was it enough that they just existed?
Shashank Joshi is The Economist's defense editor.
There's a growing number of influential American thinkers who think that nuclear deterrence is becoming much harder, and changing geopolitics, particularly the role of Russia, the role of China, the rise of North Korea, these are forcing Americans to return to some of these nuclear debates that were forgotten long ago.
So clearly this does center around the geopolitics that you mentioned. Let's start with Russia. How does that figure in today?
Well, of course, since Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, that's put the threat of war in Europe back on the agenda, and that's put nuclear security back on the agenda. But more specifically than that, Russian President Vladimir Putin has also made repeated references to nuclear weapons. So, for example, back in February and March, after French President Emmanuel Macron said that Western ground troops might need to become involved in Ukraine, Vladimir Putin said that might threaten the use of nuclear weapons and what he called the destruction of civilization. For the last 5 or 6 years, Russia has been developing and publicizing a series of what you might call exotic nuclear weapons, things like a nuclear-armed torpedo, a nuclear-powered cruise missile. And as Russia's conventional military forces have been devastated in Ukraine, what experts suggest is that the Russian Federation will be increasingly reliant on nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear weapons to protect itself. So that is completely different to what it was 10 years ago.
And what else is different, as you already mentioned, is the fact that there are more players to think about here than there were in Cold War days. Let's move on to China, for example, which we've spoken about before.
Well, for most of its history, China had an absolutely minuscule nuclear arsenal. it had no desire to catch up and keep parity with either America or indeed with the Soviet Union, which was also, of course, a big rival of China back in the Cold War. And that has completely changed. In 2019, China probably had fewer than 300 nuclear warheads. Today, it's thought to have about 500. Now, if you believe the Pentagon, it could have as many as 1,000 by the end of the decade. And to put that in perspective, America has around 1,600 deployed warheads, although it has a lot more in reserve, it must be said. China is also making a bunch of other changes to its nuclear arsenal. It's investing in, for example, early warning radars, which means that it will be able to see incoming American nuclear missiles. Why is that significant? Because the fear is that that will help China move to a posture of what we call launch on warning, not launch on attack. You don't wait for a nuclear weapon to land and then you respond, but you watch them coming in and you fire off your missiles even before the enemy ones have landed.
And what's America's response been to all this build-up, this capability building?
American nuclear strategists are juggling with a problem they have not had to think about really ever before, which is what they call the two-peer problem. How do you deter two big nuclear states, if that is indeed what China grows into? And you can see a bipartisan consensus emerging on this. In October, there was a congressionally appointed commission, the Nuclear Posture Review Commission, which included officials who had served in both the Obama and the Trump administrations. And they said, and I quote, "Nuclear force sizing and composition must account for the possibility of combined aggression from Russia and China." They said America would need to be capable of, quote, "simultaneously deterring both countries."
Well, what would that look like? How to deter both countries at once?
For the nuclear advocates, that means a larger and a more diverse arsenal. Now, America is already modernizing its nuclear forces, Jason. It's spending about $1.5 trillion on a 30-year modernization program, which would involve a new nuclear warhead, a new cruise missile, new plutonium pits, which are the bits inside the warheads, new submarines, bombers, ICBMs, you name it. But for the nuclear advocates, that isn't enough.
And you mentioned that so far all of the nuclear policy has had bipartisan support in America. What does that look like if Donald Trump were to return to the presidency?
Nobody really knows what Trump would do, Jason. But I think my feeling is he would be an advocate for a more muscular nuclear posture. He would listen to the hawks much more. Now, it doesn't mean he can just unilaterally go on a big arms race. America's not even going to meet its own target of building something like 80 new plutonium pits every year by 2030. But he could, what we call, upload warheads to existing missiles, because he has, I think, nearly 2,000 in reserve. So you could double the American arsenal pretty much at a stroke, even if you couldn't do much beyond that for a while. Russia could, of course, do the same thing, although it could only surge its own arsenal by about 57% or so. But there is a bunch of other stuff that Trump could do as well. For example, he could resume explosive nuclear testing that America hasn't done since 1992. That would be a very big deal. He could completely walk away from New START, the arms control treaty, which is due to expire in 2026. And I think the biggest impact he could have on the nuclear order globally would be the disruption to American alliances.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, America has a nuclear umbrella over Europe, over NATO, and over a number of Asian countries, including Japan and South Korea. This is a practice known as extended deterrence, to say to North Korea or to China or to Russia, if you attack my allies, I might use my nuclear weapons in response. And what we have been seeing in recent years is increasing appetite in some of these countries to think about a world without the U.S. nuclear umbrella. South Korea's president has publicly entertained the idea. In Europe, you can see flickers of discussion over how Britain and France might extend their own nuclear umbrellas in a more kind of public and confident way over the European allies. And I think that this is a really interesting moment, because for decades, one of the reasons that America has extended its nuclear umbrella over allies, it's because it did not want them to build nuclear weapons off their own. The fear was that if, for example, West Germany did so, this thing is going to precipitate a third world war with the Soviet Union. So we didn't want that. Americans didn't want that. And extended deterrence and non-proliferation were two sides of the same coin.
What you've said there seems to suggest that a lot of these questions aren't actually contingent on another Trump presidency. They're just facts about a world that's changed.
Well, remarkably, not everything is about Trump. And I think the important thing to understand is these difficult questions are going to be asked whoever is president. Because even if you think about extended deterrence and allied jitters, this isn't just about Trump walking away from alliances. This is also about the fact that an American president protecting allies with nuclear weapons faces much greater retaliation than they did 30 or 40 years ago. So even the most allied-friendly president is going to have pause for thought. And many of the questions that American nuclear planners are asking about deterring Russia and China at once, such as the problem of if one of them nukes us, do we still have to be able to nuke the other one? What will the other one do? Will they then invade us? These are kind of bizarre questions that were not being asked 10 years ago, and they will continue to be asked whether Biden is reelected, whether Trump comes into the White House, and they will be asked, I suspect, in various ways for the next generation. If you're a nuclear skeptic, your answer to all of this is to say, look, yes, these are real challenges, but America's arsenal remains 10 times bigger than that of China. The war in Ukraine shows that deterrence has held, but if you're of a more hawkish bent, you say that this is a profound and decisive shift in the nuclear environment faced by America, and there is no going back to the easy days of the early 2000s or the 1990s.
Shashank, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Jason.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to GTC. I hope you realize this is not a concert. You have arrived at a developers conference.
A developers conference? They're not supposed to be easily mistaken for a concert. All due respect to techie folk, they tend to look and feel pretty dull. But there's something about Jensen Huang, the co-founder of NVIDIA.
There will be a lot of science described. Algorithms, computer architecture, mathematics.
The company makes graphics processing units, GPUs, a particular kind of chip that's the favorite for people working in artificial intelligence. So the company is riding real high right now. Its developer conference sold out the hockey stadium in San Jose. People called it AI Woodstock. And Mr. Huang, clad in his trademark leather jacket, hopped on the stage and laid out a vision.
The industry is being transformed, not just ours. Because the computer is the single most important instrument of society today, fundamental transformations in computing affects every industry.
But he's not done with fundamental transformations. Mr. Huang went on to announce NVIDIA's next generation, a superchip called Blackwell.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce you to a very, very big GPU. Named after David Blackwell, mathematician, game theorist, probability.
For the moment, anyway, the world of AI has its hardware figurehead.
Jensen Huang has this change the world ambition when it comes to AI.
Guy Scriven is our US technology editor.
Later this year, NVIDIA, which is his company, will be releasing Blackwell. And it's going to be many times more powerful than the existing specialist AI chips. So Blackwell, this new chip, is poised to make AI become kind of bigger and cleverer.
So who are the buyers, though, of these chips?
there are two big categories of GPU buyers. The first is Alphabet, Amazon, and Microsoft. And they buy enormous amounts of these GPUs. Their customers can then access GPUs and train their own models. And another category are the kind of builders of generative AI models, like OpenAI, which is the startup behind ChatGPT. But NVIDIA finds itself in a position where it is quite dependent on a small number of customers. So it's trying to move into more sectors, healthcare and retail and manufacturing. And it's also betting that businesses are going to move from just playing around with tools like ChatGPT to building their own generative AI tools and models. And in order to sell to this new market, NVIDIA is now providing these kind of self-contained software packages that you can buy off the shelf and tailor to your own needs. And these software packages rely on NVIDIA's own GPUs to work. And so doing this further ties customers into NVIDIA's hardware system.
So instead of providing the kit that helps everybody else do AI, they are basically want to give you the one-stop AI shop. Do you think that plan will work?
It could do, but there are already hurdles here, both upstream and downstream. So if you start by thinking of upstream of NVIDIA, its suppliers are already experiencing shortages. One example of this are the South Korean suppliers of high bandwidth memory chips, which NVIDIA uses for its products. Another bottleneck is TSMC, which is a Taiwanese company that actually manufactures the chips that NVIDIA designs. They too are having shortages. Also, a lot of NVIDIA's components come from China. And with Chinese-American relations worsening day by day, this is another potential area where NVIDIA could see upstream problems and further bottlenecks.
And what about the downstream problems you mentioned?
There are lots of concerns that the existing grid in America won't be able to keep up with having lots of data centers full of GPUs. GPUs use much more energy than conventional semiconductors. Jensen Huang's answer to this is to make GPUs more efficient. So when Jensen Huang was talking about the new Blackwell chip, he mentioned that it can train a ChatGPT-like model using only a quarter as much energy as the current best semiconductors. But even though the Blackwell system is more efficient, it still requires huge amounts more energy than non-AI chips and non-AI data centers. By some estimates, that could be 20 times more energy. A further wrinkle with efficiency is that it can actually lead to more power consumption overall, because demand for those chips and that artificial intelligence goes up again. And in some ways, you can already see this. So for instance, Amazon Web Services, which is the cloud computing arm of Amazon, last month bought a data center which comes attached to a nuclear power station.
But you mentioned that Mr. Huang has already talked about efficiency. He's clearly aware of these risks in some way. What's he say about them?
Yeah, Mr. Huang is very clearly kind of aware of these problems. But at the moment, he's just much more focused on talking up the positive side of generative AI. So he spends a lot of time talking about productivity boosts and how AI can generate new profits and create new jobs and new streams of revenue. If somebody is going to actually be building these AI factories of the future, Mr. Huang certainly plans that it's going to be him.
Guy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Jason.
Our colleagues over on Babbage, our weekly show on science and technology, have just finished a four-part series called The Science That Built the AI Revolution. It looks at how human intelligence inspired AI, how it works, how it became generative. If you haven't done it already, sign up to our Economist Podcasts Plus package and go check it out. And if you're a subscriber to The Economist, you can join a live event later today hosted by our science and technology editor and Babbage host, Alok Jha, answering your questions about AI. Register at economist.com/AI event. As nicknames for jobs go, bean counter is pretty derogatory.
Then again, the job of accountant has never been perceived as one of the sexiest. Yet they've always been around, like since the original bean counters, the Mesopotamians, who used little clay markers to keep track of agricultural goods. The profession goes back that far because bean counters are crucial to commerce. So, sexy reputation or no, it's a problem that there are ever fewer of them on the books.
The United States is running out of accountants. There were about 1.6 million in America last year, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's down from almost 2 million just a few years ago in 2019.
Emily McQuarrie Ruiz Esparza writes about business for The Economist.
And the drop-off is having an impact on businesses' bookkeeping abilities.
So what's going on here? What's happening to all the accountants?
Many of them are retiring. In 2019, three quarters of accountants were nearing retirement age, which means, of course, many of them have retired by 2024. And there are too few young people lining up to replace them and take those accounting jobs. Only 65,000 students completed an accounting degree in 2022, down from 80,000 between 2012 and 2018. Many accountants are retiring with the baby boomer generation, and there aren't enough Gen Zers lining up to take these new jobs.
I mean, do we have a sense for why Gen Z doesn't want into that job in particular?
Yes, there are a few reasons that Gen Z is not interested. The first is that accounting has a reputation for being boring. Film and TV famously lampoon this profession as being repetitive and dry and unexciting, something that a calculator could do. The other reason is that there are other professions that are similar that are far more appealing. So for instance, finance jobs like advisors or traders, they require less time in school, less training, and they pay a lot more upon graduation.
And you said that this decline is having a real impact on businesses. What do you mean?
Well, the problem is businesses need accountants. So, for example, Advance Auto Parts, which is an auto parts supplier in the U.S., they blamed the loss or turnover of accounting personnel for delayed financial filings. In 2023, according to Bloomberg, more than 700 companies blamed lack of accounting personnel for errors in their statements. That's up one-third from 2019. So unless more people are attracted to the profession, these problems are only going to get worse.
So how to reverse that then? How to make accountancy more attractive as a profession? Surely just pay them more money.
This is difficult. So there are some companies and organizations that are trying to rebrand the profession. PwC, for one, they're one of the big four accounting firms. They're working with professors at universities to make those entry-level accounting courses more interesting, more exciting, and focus on the career possibilities rather than just the rote task of how do you bookkeep, basically. A lot of the grunt work that's unappealing to young people is actually now handled by computers. They still have to learn it in school, but once they begin their career, they really won't have to be doing much of that. And that's what accounting professors and firms like PwC and trade organizations, that's what they want young people to understand and know that while the computer is handling the number crunching, they'll be able to do more of the interpretive work.
So do you think that's going to work? Do you think that getting rid of the more tedious stuff and, I don't know, jazzing it up a bit is going to bring more people into the profession? Or is it a terminal tailspin now?
I think the profession needs better marketing that is directed at young people. There are some organizations that are doing this. The American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, or the AICPA, for instance, they have a TikTok feed called AICPA Student. It's full of career tips and how to get into the profession, the benefits of working as a CPA. And that feed features a lot of young accountants who are living their best accountant lives, talking about how great it is to be an accountant. Organizations and trade partnerships are sponsoring individual TikTok influencers to talk about how great it is to work in this profession. The trouble is, on TikTok, accountant is sometimes used as a code word for sex worker. It's used that way because when you say you're an accountant, it's seen as such a boring job. Why would you follow that up with any question about what it's like to be an accountant? In fact, sometimes it's used to deflect attention from other complicated or unappealing jobs. There's a TikToker, a comedian named Rocky Patera, who's used this term when he doesn't want to explain to a stranger that he's a struggling or out-of-work actor. So he actually wrote a song about it that spawned a pretty popular TikTok meme.
I have a full-time job as an accountant. As an accountant. Nobody asks you questions when you say you're an accountant.
What do you do?
I'm an accountant.
Where do you work?
At a place where accountants work.
Do you like your job?
Yes, I like my job, and my job is an accountant.
A lot of influencers have had to clarify which profession they're endorsing. So saying, I'm actually endorsing accounting as a profession, not sex work.
So as long as everybody's sure what it is they're being sold, you think selling to them, as it were, on TikTok is the way to go?
I think that will be part of it. Something that accounts like the AICPA's feed or others like Accounting Plus, they're still somewhat created by older folks trying to make an uncool profession sound cool to younger folks. So they're full of dad jokes like be audit you can be. So I'm not entirely sure how those are going to land. But the AICPA student account does have more than 21,000 followers, so they're doing something right, and they may be able to appeal, especially if they're having young people speak to other young people on their behalf.
Thanks very much for your time, Emily.
Thank you.
Like your job?
Yes, I like my job, and my job is an accountant.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.